From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, University of Utah atmospheric scientist John Lynn. He's a member of NASA's science team for the Orbiting Carbon Observatory 2, or OCO2 satellite, which will measure carbon dioxide levels in various regions around the globe from space.
We know roughly that globally, throughout the whole world, about 70% of the energy-related emissions of carbon dioxide is related to cities. We want to know just how much each city is emitting.
That conversation, your summary of the day's top local headlines, and an update from the World Cup, just ahead on The Rundown, here on KCPW. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up a little bit later on the show, a conversation with a University of Utah scientist about his involvement in the launch of a NASA satellite to track global carbon dioxide levels. But first up, we have these headlines. The Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office announced on Thursday that they were filing a charge in the 2012 police shooting of Danielle Willard. Former West Valley City Police Detective Sean Cowley will be charged with second-degree manslaughter for Willard's death. Willard was shot during a drug investigation involving two West Valley City officers. Cowley was fired as a result of the incident. Detective Cowley was taken into custody on Thursday and then posted a $10,000 bail, according to the Salt Lake Tribune. The other officer, Kevin Salmon, was not charged. The investigation for this case has taken over a year and a half, and Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill says it's a case that has had its fair share of complexities.
Well, there's nothing been ordinary about this investigation from its inception. And then, of course, the collateral issues that surrounded the shooting, which were involved with West Valley, certainly added a level of complexity to it. This is a very serious allegation.
Because of the complicated circumstances, which included a now-disbanded West Valley City narcotics unit mired in scandal, Gill says his office employed the help of outside experts for the investigation.
We brought in a team of outside homicide detectives, then re-examined the totality of the evidence, and they were brought together with no expectation, and their job was to look at all the evidence and to follow up with any experts. And in fact, the last expert came into town about a week and a half ago, and when we were done with that, we decided to file charges.
Cowley's attorney was expected to release a statement later on Thursday. If convicted, Cowley could face up to 15 years in prison. The state of Utah is planning to set up a new private laboratory space to speed up a backlog in evidence related to rape. Lawmakers this year set aside $750,000 toward the effort. They say the state crime lab has had too few resources for years, and it's held up about 2,000 samples from undergoing analysis. When medical workers treat people for sexual assault, they collect DNA and other evidence and then lock it in a rape or Code R kit. Advocates say rape kits remain unanalyzed in police storage in Utah, putting off prosecutions indefinitely and denying justice for victims. Lab Director Jay Henry says the state will soon ask for proposals and select a firm by year's end. The Salt Lake Tribune reports that the Utah Department of Public Safety currently oversees the lab. After the state public records panel ordered Bluffdale to release documents related to the National Security Agency's data center, the city has decided to cut the panel out of its public records appeals process. The city council made that decision official last week in a unanimous vote. In March, the panel ordered the city to release to the Salt Lake Tribune records about the water that Bluffdale sells to the data hub south of Salt Lake City. Bluffdale City Attorney Vaughn Pickle says the new policy is unrelated to the NSA decision. Open government advocates argue that the move makes it less likely that records will be released during disputes. The Salt Lake Tribune reports that the council will instead consider the appeals. After that, further appeals will go to the state court. That does it for our summary of the day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. This is The Rundown. We'll be right back. It's day 8 of the 2014 FIFA World Cup. And throughout the tournament, KCPW's Ryan Cunningham and Real Salt Lake blogger Matt Montgomery are providing daily updates, along with some insights into the stories surrounding the world's favorite sport.
Well, Matt Montgomery, it's day 8 and another day, another set of surprising and exciting results in the World Cup. What did we miss yesterday?
Yesterday was Croatia smashing Cameroon 4-0. It was particularly interesting to see Cameroon get a red card in the first half. Player's mind just must have slipped away from him because he elbowed a guy in the back in front of the referee with a giant swing of the elbow. Just impossible to not notice. Croatia really took advantage. All signs point to them going through, and I would be scared of Croatia going into the knockout stages. A 4-0 win is nothing to be shouted down.
Yeah, they lost to Brazil, but they looked pretty good in that game too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we have two results today. What were those?
The first one, Colombia beat the Ivory Coast 2-1. Nothing too controversial about that. Two nations that are probably pretty equally matched. And then the big one of the day, England falling to Uruguay 2-1. Again, England with one of their prototypical World Cup
flat-out disappointment.
Yeah, they've done it so many times. It's hard to really be surprised. But it's still a great result for Uruguay, who were struggling in the group after losing to Costa Rica.
England invented the sport. They have 53 million people. Uruguay hosted the first World Cup. They have 3 million people. And they have actually won the World Cup one more time than England has. England has won it once. Uruguay has won it twice. Why is a country of 3 million people, which is roughly the size of Utah, why are they doing so well in the World Cup?
Well, their last World Cup win was 1950. So to be fair, it's not like they're on the world stage just smashing everything apart right now. They did make the semifinals in 2010 and lost to Holland. They've had some success recently, but their early success is really interesting because you don't typically see these smaller countries with very small pools to pull from doing so well. I mean, usually it's Brazil over Uruguay, and in 1950, I think everybody thought it would be, so far as they actually made medals for the Brazilian team before the final was played. They had no trophy presentation ceremony in 1950 because Uruguay was not at all expected to win. Brazil was going through just smashing teams like 5-1, 6-1, so a really surprising one then. And to see them continue to do well is interesting because they're still tiny. They didn't have, like, a population boom. They're, what, the 133rd in the world population? It's fascinating to see because it's everybody groups around it. It's more than just a working class thing. It's more than just, like, an upper class thing. It's just something they do in Uruguay.
Okay, well, get out the calculators and scratch paper. This is where the group stage gets complicated. I look forward to seeing what happens later today and tomorrow. Matt Montgomery, again, thanks for coming in.
Hey, thank you.
Again, that was KCPW's Ryan Cunningham with blogger Matt Montgomery, who writes about Real Salt Lake at rslsoapbox.com. You can also follow Matt's Twitter handle, @thecrossbarRSL, and find all of these segments at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough, and this is The Rundown. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Now on the show, we're joined by Dr. John Lynn, a University of Utah atmospheric scientist who is a member of NASA's science team for the Orbiting Carbon Observatory 2, or OCO2, satellite, which is the first NASA satellite dedicated to measuring the global distribution of climate-warming carbon dioxide gas. Dr. Lynn, thanks very much for joining us to talk about this project.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
This satellite has a research mission, which is to gather data on atmospheric CO2 levels. How does it conduct these measurements? And I guess, where is it doing the measuring, if that makes sense?
Sure. The way the satellite works is it measures reflected sunlight. So what happens is there are really accurate instruments on board the satellite pointing down toward the Earth, and it measures the strength of the sunlight being reflected from the Earth. From that, they can actually determine, amazingly, the total amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, because carbon dioxide absorbs in certain part of the wavelength of the sunlight. You can put a certain amount of carbon dioxide in the laboratory and measure how much it absorbs the sunlight, then you can back out exactly how much carbon dioxide there is.
So we can kind of think of it as the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere filtering out a certain section of light, and by seeing, how much light kind of isn't hitting, isn't being measured,
That's
how much
carbon dioxide. That's a great way to do it, yeah.
Is this a better way of measuring carbon dioxide content in the atmosphere than, say, doing it on the ground?
It depends on what you want, actually. If you just want a value of carbon dioxide, let's say here in Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
And we do that, actually. My colleague Jamel Ehringer has been doing that for over 10 years.
Oh.
So he's been measuring carbon dioxide right here in Salt Lake City.
Wow.
And that measurement is actually much more precise than the satellite. Because you have a ground-based measurement, you can do a lot of things you can't do in space.
Okay.
So naturally, the question is, why bother? Why spend the money, taxpayers' money, to send up the satellite? And that's where this strength of the satellite comes in, because, as you said, these measurements in Salt Lake City are very local. Mm-hmm. But if you want to look at the whole world, that's where the real strength of satellites comes in. So you can fly all over the world and look down. And one aspect that's very poorly sampled is carbon dioxide over the oceans. Or if you think about in the middle of the jungles, there just aren't that many people there or infrastructure to facilitate it in developing countries as well. So all these places, the OCO2 will be able to fill in.
And this satellite, the OCO2, how quickly is it orbiting the Earth? I mean, how many passes does it make or will it make?
It constantly sort of orbits around the Earth, and the Earth turns as it orbits, and it makes a passing through the equator at 1:30 in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And then you make multiple passes during the day. And then every 16 days, it returns to the same location.
Okay.
That's the way the orbit is set up. So what that means, you'll get global coverage, the whole world, about twice per month of the same spot.
Every 2 weeks, it's hitting the same spot.
The same spot. Yeah, that's basically. Right. That's right.
Well, that's I'm gonna kind of turn us back towards the research aspect of it. You yourself are one of the things you're looking at in particular is carbon dioxide emissions from the world's so-called mega cities. These larger than a certain
10 million,
larger than 10 million people cities. Tell us about what you're aiming to find out with that research.
Yeah. So the initial aspect is pretty simple. We want to know just how much each city is emitting, and we know roughly that globally, throughout the whole world, about 70% of the energy-related emissions of carbon dioxide is related to cities.
Mm.
So they are really lion's share of emissions. So cities overall. And the megacities, these humongous cities, comprise a major fraction of that.
Of that 70%.
Mm-hmm. So if you're thinking about really hot spots where a lot of emissions are taking place, then that it seems natural to look at these. These are where a lot of people are concentrated, and they are doing a lot of things from driving cars to heating their homes, and that leads to a lot of emissions.
And so as this satellite goes mm-hmm. over some of these megacities, you'll look at basically data coming from those cities when it comes to how much carbon dioxide is around the city there.
That's right. Okay. That's so. So let me take Salt Lake City as example, although we're not a mega city,
right.
But we're sizable. So we know for a fact from our ground-based measurements that the carbon dioxide is higher in Salt Lake City than out west in the desert.
Sure.
Okay. So that's a well-established fact. And that's because we here are emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere of Salt Lake City. So that creates, some people call it a CO2 dome, like a dome of air that's higher in carbon dioxide over these cities. And that's even more pronounced, a much higher higher value over places like LA or Tokyo,
sure.
Seoul, pick your favorite megacity, Paris, you know. Those are really, again, hot spots of really high values of carbon dioxide compared to surroundings.
I guess one aspect that I have, a question that I have about this is, will OCO2 be able to give us an even more accurate count when it comes to the parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere? And if you're looking at megacities, does that carbon dioxide distribute across the globe? Or is, I mean, you talked about this dome, but it sounds like it's kind of trapped in one particular location. And then I guess seeing how that might affect, the greenhouse effect is another aspect of that.
I guess there are many aspects to this.
Yeah, that's two questions. I'm sorry. Maybe four questions.
Now, well, let's address it one by one. So carbon dioxide, once it's emitted in the atmosphere, doesn't stay in one place.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be blown around by the wind patterns, and we'll probably talk about it later, but it actually it's taken up by plants as part of their photosynthesis as they grow.
Of course.
So they're part of this gigantic carbon cycle. However, because emissions are so persistent and high in cities, that high value stays over the city. So you can imagine a molecule of carbon dioxide being emitted to the atmosphere, but it gets blown out, but there's another molecule to replace it we go through.
That makes sense. Do you have specific equipment on this satellite to help you with the study that you're doing?
I personally don't. There are only a limited number of sensors on there, and they're, as you can imagine, very, very precise. And my research focuses more on using the data, and I develop computer models to interpret the data. Specifically, I run computer models of the atmosphere to try to predict how that carbon dioxide is blown around.
Interesting. Yeah. How I'm curious, Dr. Lin, how did you get involved in this? I mean, is there a sort of selection process, or do you submit a query to NASA, or do they come and knock on your door?
Well, it's a mixture of both. If I go way back, then, you know, maybe during my high school days, I've always been interested in environmental issues in one or another. So I wanted to do something to better understand our natural surroundings and from a greater understanding, hopefully, to protect it better.
You know, actually, before we proceed any further, maybe we should talk about why CO2 presents such a threat to the planet.
Sure. Carbon dioxide is somewhat special in that it doesn't necessarily cause significant health problems.
By itself.
That's correct. So you and I just breathing in and out in this room probably has created a very high level of carbon dioxide. We've created our own CO2 dome right here in this studio. However, we're not keeling over right now. That being said, it's very well understood that carbon dioxide is what's known as a greenhouse effect. So how that works is it traps heat, and we know that very well from laboratory studies. We could see how much heat it traps. So that aspect is pretty much not really debated at all among scientists. With that well-known fact, there's any number of studies that's showing as we pump more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it would trap more heat, hence causing a change in our climate.
Yeah. Right. There are climate deniers, but I mean, the vast majority of scientists around the world are in accordance on this, right?
Oh, yes. And I should mention there's a recent, very authoritative report that came out from what's known as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change,
right,
or IPCC for short. It involves thousands of scientists around the world. And that report, I think, came out just a few months ago, essentially says carbon dioxide is a contributor of climate change.
Adding to the evidence, right? Mm-hmm. We talked about your interest in studying the environment, but I'm wondering how you got on the NASA science team. Was it just kind of...
Oh, that's right. I haven't answered that. Yeah, so the way it works is you write proposals to NASA telling about what you want to do.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. You know, my proposal was selected. And actually, there will be another round of proposals once it's launched.
Yeah.
So because it's public data at some point. So any scientist around the world can use the data. That's amazing. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Open source. Yeah.
Open source
satellite. And NASA's really unique in that. I should give them great credit.
Other agencies have proprietary...
Some.
Interesting. So, you know, actually, one thing that I'm curious about, and since we have been talking a little bit about climate change and the role that carbon dioxide plays in that, could OCO2 be used as a regulatory instrument, meaning to help enforce carbon reduction goals if, say, world governments came to a major climate change agreement? Could it be used for that?
There's potential for it. Because of this global coverage, as I said, that's a real key strength of this satellite to measure around the world. So the hope is to be able to combine that data, the carbon dioxide data, with models of the atmosphere. Examples are like the things I run in my lab, and essentially back out the amount of emissions from different areas of the world. Mm-hmm. So it is possible. There are complications. The complications are the wind pattern changes in the atmosphere is complicated. So you have to account for that. And that's something I'll be working on in order to essentially better calculate the emissions from these megacities. And for that matter, you could also move the domain to other places and look at the amount of emissions from different areas of the world.
Yeah. Right. And I understand the complications, but it's interesting to think about the idea of measuring it and being able to say, all right, we know that you're actually not reducing emissions here,
right,
and this is going on.
There are some very prominent examples of that kind of regulatory. One example I'll give is the nuclear. IAEA is the international agency. They're based in Vienna.
Right.
And they make all these measurements around the world in the atmosphere. And if there's any secret nuclear weapon testing, then those that shows up as a signature in the atmosphere.
They're aware of it, yeah.
They're aware of it. So in some sense, the carbon dioxide questions, the regulatory, maybe will evolve into something like that.
There's a framework for it already, maybe.
Exactly, yeah.
Hmm. You know, you talked about modeling and the research that you're doing based mm-hmm. on those models. Maybe you could describe that a little bit more. I mean, in layman's terms for radio, it might be a little bit hard, but you're looking at the megacities and then you're using computer models to try and determine what, to apply what data to it, I guess.
The way my models work is I actually run the tape recorder backward in time. I run the atmospheric winds backward in time. And then I ask the question, if I measure something in the atmosphere, where does it come from? So let's say if OCO2 measures the increased amount of carbon dioxide over the megacity or just downwind of it, I could go back and say this region of the megacity emitted that. And I could actually run the tape back even further and trace it to other aspects because there are other sources of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, like forest fires. So we don't want to mistakenly attribute the increased carbon dioxide to non-megacity sources. You sort of have to account for that.
That's fascinating. I mean, it's a detective work is what you're doing.
Detective work, yeah, yeah.
I've read that this is OCO, so it's called OCO2. What happened to OCO1?
OCO1 was the original instrument that was launched in 2009. And unfortunately, what happened was the rocket that was supposed to carry OCO1 to space did not separate from the satellite itself. So there was a failure of the rocket mechanism. And what happened is the rocket then just plunged from space, carrying OCO1 with it. So there was a really unfortunate failure of the mission.
When did that happen?
That happened in 2009.
I'm just going to remind our listeners that I'm speaking to Dr. John Lin, a University of Utah atmospheric scientist who is a member of NASA's science team for the Orbiting Carbon Observatory 2, or OCO2 satellite. Dr. Lin, another question that I have is, have other satellites measured other gases on Earth? I mean, has this kind of thing been done before using the same technique?
So I should mention and give credit to the Japanese satellite, and it's called GOSAT. And in some ways, the idea is quite similar to OCO2 to measure carbon dioxide around the world. And it was launched roughly at the same time as OCO1.
Okay.
And unfortunately, OCO1 failed. So GOSAT right now is really the only instrument that has the necessary accuracy to map carbon dioxide out around the world. Now, there are a lot of advances in OCO2 that we hope will improve upon GOSAT. Mm-hmm. And one of the improvements we hope is that there's less interference from clouds. Mm-hmm. So as I explained in the beginning, you want to measure reflected sunlight.
Correct.
So if a cloud is covering the area of the ground you're looking at, then you can't see below it. So it's a major problem.
And you can account for, OCO2 is trying to account for that somehow?
Yeah, so they do it in having a sharper view on the ground. So GOSAT right now, you can imagine, it's like looking at a very broad area.
Sure.
If you look at the Earth from space, you see a lot of clouds. So if you're looking at a very broad area at one time, it's highly likely there's a cloud there interfering with your measurement.
Of course.
So GOSAT actually throws out a lot of data because they can't see below the clouds. OCO2 has a very sharp view that hopefully will minimize that kind of contamination from the clouds.
Okay. When is the launch of OCO2?
The launch is July 1st at 3-something in the morning. It's close to 4 a.m.
Where does it launch from?
It is being launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base on the coast of California.
Wow. And what have you been doing to prepare for the launch?
Well, I have been preparing my family. So I am actually going to take my two little kids to the launch,
which
I think will be quite an experience for them. They'll probably be asleep during the launch. But, you know, I might get a picture of them at the launch. And 10 years later, I'll say, you know, you were at the launch. Yeah.
Will we ever be able to see OCO2 going over the skies of Salt Lake City?
I don't think so, but I don't want to say for a fact. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, okay. It's pretty high up. It's about 483 miles above the surface, so that's, I don't know how visible it'll be.
Incredible.
But I should mention NASA has a constellation of satellites, so they call it the A-Train. The A-Train, so they have like five satellites flying in formation, one after the other. And OCO2 will be the lead of that constellation. It'll fly at the forefront. And it's an amazing concept where you have a number of satellites orbiting the same patch of Earth, looking down at the same place but measuring different properties. They're measuring things from cloud properties to rain to other pollutants other than carbon dioxide. So it's really amazing.
That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Finally, when can we start, or when should we start expecting results from this, measurements, data being collected?
So it's going to be several months before we get it because they have to do a lot of things from quality assurance and making sure the measurements are of sufficient quality. So it's going to be a number of months. We won't get it a day after July 1st, but
once instruments are calibrated and they know that it's functioning properly, then you can expect to start getting the data that you need to do your
research.
That's right. Well, it's fascinating work. We really appreciate your coming in and taking the time to speak with us. And I'll just remind our listeners that we've been speaking with Dr. John Lin, a University of Utah atmospheric scientist and a member of NASA's Orbiting Carbon Observatory 2, or OCO2, satellite science team. Thanks very much for coming in, and best of luck with the launch.
Thank you.
You can find this conversation and all of our past interviews at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. This is The Rundown. Stay with us. Thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. Additional help came from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. We're on the air each weekday at 5 p.m. here on KCPW, but you can also find us on Twitter. Our handle is at KCPWRundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.